There is a podcast brewing that's about to take over podcasting for good. The only podcast that you are going to need to tune into day in, day out, is the Member Guest Podcast.
If I can hit it down the middle of the fairway, that's great. But again, with the driver right now, the driver sucks.
John Daly, and you're listening to the Member Guest Podcast. Rip it, rip it.
All right. Welcome to another episode of the Member Guest Podcast. This is one of your hosts, Andy, here. It's a pleasure tonight as we are joined by one of my best friends in the world, Danny Holson. Danny, welcome to the podcast, brother.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me. I've been a longtime listener. I'm excited to join the conversation. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Yes.
I'm super pumped that you're willing to do this. I know we've been like working on it for a while. So I think just to set the stage a little bit. So Danny is like one of my best friends over the last, 15 years or longer. We kind of grew up together and have spent a lot of nights, on the phone, talking till the wee hours of the morning, both ways, Danny helping me with like things in my life and, me being an ear to him to the extent that I've been helpful, which is probably not much. He's just like one of the more, inspiring and interesting like people that I know, and, has a really cool story that, when I think about like, golf and trying to play competitive golf. And, Danny's like actually probably been the most helpful person to me, as it relates to like my approach and how I think about, competing in athletics. And, so I'm really excited to like dig into his story and share some of those lessons, with the rest of our audience. I think, things got started for us, in seventh grade.
What year was that? That must have been 2004, something like that.
2004. Yeah. I was like a much superior in every way to Danny, kind of back then. He was just a little guy. And no,
Andy hit the maturity train before I did. He was about 5 years earlier than I was. I was a late bloom.
Yeah. Danny bloomed, and boy, did he bloom. And, I shrunk away. I guess like, I can share from like a third party perspective. Like, I think you were always, cause we always like played against each other, played baseball against each other even before that. And we're kind of like rivals in a way, at least like our teams were, going back to the Spiders BCC days.
Andy was at 14 years old. That was hitting the ball to the fence and over the fence, and we were struggling to run around the bases without having to buff and getting the ball over the infield.
My perception of you was like you were always a gamer, you were undersized like when we were much younger, but you always had like really elite actions, it was clear to you that like, sports and baseball in particular like came very natural to you. I don't think you like worked a lot on mechanics, like you just had a very natural motion. And maybe talk a little bit through like just like your early days of kind of playing sports. And you also like baseball wasn't the only sport you played.
I think thinking about those days back then, like all you cared about was playing. You didn't think, you didn't care about getting in the right positions. You just went out and had fun, right? Like, I think that is a good reminder sometimes, even at this age, for some of the athletes that I work with. But thinking about it back then, it was all about just like a very directed, I'm trying to get the ball over there, so I want to throw it that way, I want to do this. You weren't really conscious inwardly about what you were doing. You were very outcome based. You didn't think about it that way. But I think at that age, you were just so conscious of the result that that's all that drove you. And that's, a good thing sometimes, but I think the big thing was just having fun and not really giving a shit about any of the stuff that you can get in your head as you get older. And growing up, yeah, I loved baseball. Baseball was my passion. I played football at 5'7", 140 pounds of prepubescent mass, and that didn't last long. And I ran cross country one year, which was probably the biggest mistake of my life. That was a tough. I don't have a runner's. I didn't have a runner's body then, and I still don't now. So I did it because I was trying to get in shape, and our baseball coach gave me the option of either running cross country or wrestling. So I chose cross country. But even, yeah. So, and then, yeah, played
basketball. That was back when you were drinking a gallon of water a day. You'd walk around with that giant gallon.
Yeah.
I still do that. Trying to lose weight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But yeah, it was just all about having fun back then. You didn't really care or think. And just like growing up playing sports with my older brother was hugely helpful to me, where you have the one goal of just beating your brother's ass, and he's bigger than you and stronger than you and better than you at everything. So you kind of upped your game a little bit. And yeah, I think that kind of just manifested itself in just kind of a fluid athletic kind of movement profile, I guess. I don't know what you would call it,
yeah.
But I think the biggest thing was just not caring. You didn't know enough to have these inner voices in your head, like that we'll get into in a minute, but those were just completely silent. You can just go out and have fun.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting that you say that, because I can relate to that too. And we've talked a lot about that as well. Just like, you know, it's almost like you're just so in the moment and like present, you know, where you are, and you know, you're not thinking about like mechanics, or you know, you're not thinking about like you know, stupid things. You're just thinking about like playing the game, and
you're literally just thinking about the things that matter, and that's winning, that's having fun, like that. There's so much stuff that compiles over time about, you know, outward voices that come into your head, and those are necessary, but they're also another fence that they're a fence that you have to jump over and deal with, mm-hmm. right? But even that advice of just going out and playing like a kid, like in my professional baseball playing days, was something I struggled with, but got a lot better at when I kind of let go of it.
Yeah.
Thought like that.
Yeah. So you end up becoming a very highly recruited, you know, athlete. You end up going to the University of Virginia, which we were, you know, we were in the Thomas family. We're all pretty stoked about, you know, being a bunch of Virginia fans. And obviously my brother, John was there, and my dad was there. And you kind of jump right in at UVA, and, you know, I think you're a freshman All-American. You're playing both ways. You end up having a historic college career. Win the John Olerud Award for the best two-way player in the nation. You're a Golden Spikes Award finalist, or did you win that? I don't know if you won that.
I didn't win it. I think I got second.
Okay, you got second. Who won that?
Trevor Bauer.
Okay, yeah. So, so you kind of just, and that was kind of a big thing. Is like you went. I think most people probably expected that you would. Most people probably didn't expect that you were going to go there and like light it up right away. And you kind of did, and you had this like really rapid rise. You want to talk just for a minute about your college career and kind of what that experience was like?
Sure. Yeah. The glory days. Those are some of the best years of my life, man. That was, playing with your best friends and doing what you love. It doesn't get better than that. And yeah, like as far as what it felt like entering college. Yeah, I was a scrawny kid that threw hard. And then as I got older, I kind of jumped up the scale a little bit, like maturity wise. I actually hit puberty. So that I started to throw harder. I started to get more attention from professional scouts. But at that time, I like didn't care about that, right? Like all I cared about, and I think it's a culture thing at UVA, our coaches were unbelievable about being in the moment, taking care of what needed to be taken care of right then and there, not worrying about all the extra stuff. And speaking from personal experience, I was able to do that, right? Like, and any extra voices of anxiety or underperformance, like didn't really enter your head. And it was playing like a kid in a lot of ways. You certainly learned a lot more about the technicality of, you know, pitching mechanics and game strategy. So those nuances started to flow a lot more in the college game, right? So there's more things to think about, but it was still very, very much going out there and competing. And, you know, fun is a relative term, but it was like, you go out there and compete and do what you got to do, and there's nothing else that matters. And at that age, it was a super important lesson to learn that how valuable that is to quiet the voices that are outside of you. And that's something that was drilled into us at a very early age. I remember the first day we stepped there, it was like every practice and every scrimmage was the College World Series. And that is a mindset that I thought was so powerful that you practice like you play. And I know that's said all the time, but to truly do that is incredibly powerful, because when you actually do get in those moments, you have the confidence that to say, I've done this already. I'm not anxious. I'm not worried. I'm capable. I'm confident. And that was repeatedly drilled into us. And even the little things like not doing your warm up right or not doing a drill right. Like, our coaches were all over us. And at that age, you certainly need that to learn the power of that. And then that produced like a very intense culture of winning and doing the right thing and playing the game the right way. And it was an unbelievable learning experience, both on the baseball field and off the field.
Yeah, and you really flourished in that type of a culture. And some people don't. Some people do really well in that type of culture. And I think it really brought the best out of you in college. And you know, you talked about learning some of the practice habits and the discipline. And you know, I know, you know, certainly your career it didn't come easy, and you worked very, very, very hard. And so, you know, I want to get into like draft night, right? So, you know, you're sitting around the TV with your college teammates and friends, and a lot of guys, you know, we're friends with today. What was it like having your name called? You were the second pick in the draft. Right behind Garrett Cole, who was the number one overall pick. What was that experience like? And just talk us through that.
Yeah, it's to this day I still struggle verbalizing what it felt like, but in one word it was wild, because I knew I had the sense that I was going to be pretty high up there, which would have been awesome, which was going to be awesome. And even if I fell a little bit, like I still like was going to be in a good position. So personally, I was like happy with anywhere that I would have gotten drafted. But I remember sitting there, and I'm not one for a show or anything like that. So, but we had all our teammates, or all my teammates and all my coaches, my parents were there watching this TV, and which was awesome. It was, that support system is unbelievable. But at the time, all the attention was on me, and I was slightly uncomfortable with that. But besides the point. I sit on the couch, and they give me a microphone to watch the TV and then listen in. And then listening to the broadcast, my microphone was like 3 or 4 seconds ahead of the TV that everybody was watching. So it was a little confusing, like watching this and hearing stuff a little earlier, all that. And so Garrett Cole gets picked as expected. And then I kind of had in my mind that I was going to be in the, you know, fifth, sixth, like maybe fourth, that type of area. So I was just kind of chilling, and so was everybody else. And I hear in my microphone that the Mariners with the number 2 overall pick select Danny Holson. And I just freak out, right? Like I put my hands on my head and I'm like, did that actually happen? And no one's really paying attention because nobody's really expecting it. And then they see me react. And then 3 seconds later, they see it on the TV. And then we went wild. It was awesome. That was an unbelievable moment. But then again, like, then we talked about, you know, voices in your head and the extraneous stuff that comes into play at that stage. And pretty instantly it hit me that, like, damn, I got some expectations to live up to. I got drafted higher than I thought, and I wasn't expecting this. And I got, you know, people to please. I got some big shoes to fill here. And that really affected me. And that kind of was, you know, I attribute that mentality of, like, trying to live up to expectations and make other people happy, kind of the downfall of where my professional career went.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would argue that injuries were your downfall, but I certainly, you know, understand having talked through a lot of that with you over time. And that being said, though, I mean, you know, you get into the Mariners system and you know, right away you're having success, right? Pretty quickly you're flying through the system. You're one of the top prospects in baseball. It wasn't like you weren't having success, but it came at a great toll on you mm-hmm. mentally. And so, you know, talk us a little bit through some of those emotions that you felt, some of the imposter syndrome of, like, you know, it, like, you know, I'm like, did you feel like you weren't as good as people thought you were? Like, what were the voices, like, going on in your head?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. I'll try to summarize it as much as I can. But yeah, man, like, I got into the Mariner system, being drafted that high, felt like all eyes were on me all the time. And then in the professional baseball world, it's, you know, the minor leagues are about getting to the major leagues, and it's a very individual based, right? Like, your success is your driving goal, and, like, that's the way it has to be, right? No one really cares about the Southern League championship in professional baseball. Certainly while you're there, mm-hmm. you try to win as many games as possible. But if you ask any individual, it's about getting to the major leagues, right? So that kind of focus was something that I didn't really realize was having an impact on me, right? So I get all this, like, attention and all this, you know, a couple accolades and some really cool stuff. As I tell the story, it sounds like I'm biting the silver spoon, which I am a little bit, but it really did affect me, man. I tried to please people. I tried to live up to lofty expectations, most of which I made up myself, right? Like, there's a certain level of performance that's expected out of the second overall pick, especially a college pitcher. So I felt like I had to live up to every single one of those standards and get to the major leagues fast, perform at the major leagues fast, and have a sustained career for the worst reasons, right? My driving motivations were not the little kid playing baseball anymore. It was to make other people happy, to live up to these expectations, to not be a bust. And as I alluded to earlier, like, the way I dealt with that was, like, I internalized it all, right? And I was embarrassed to talk to people about it. I was, I didn't want to feel or come across as weak. I think verbalizing that stuff made me feel weak. So I kept it all in. And then when my shoulder started to hurt, I kept throwing because I didn't want to be the second overall pick that got hurt and was a bust. I did not want to be that guy. I didn't want to disappoint people. So I threw and threw and threw and just made my arm hurt more and more and more. And it's so stupid looking back on it, but it's a very real thing that I lived through. And I know a lot of guys live through is living, like, sacrificing your body, your mind for expectations of other people. And it's a regret that I have is in my professional baseball playing experience was playing for other people that didn't matter, and not playing either for yourself or for your team, or just winning and going out and just having fun, right? Like, the fun thing is a little tricky sometimes, but the point is like, I was worrying about the wrong shit.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny because you know, I think, you know, golf is an individual sport, right? And yeah, like, you know, it sounds really stupid. I mean, the reason I wanted to, like, have you on the podcast is because a lot of our listeners, you know, play competitive golf, or they're trying to compete in their club championship, or they you know, like whatever it is. And inevitably, like folks do get to that place where they're putting pressure on themselves. You know, I mean, look, I was there last year. You know, we have this McKinsey Cup team that's like, you know, if you make the McKinsey Cup team at our club, it's like big deal, right? It's like, you know, whatever the 12, you know, there's only 12 guys selected. And I made it 2 years ago. And last year, like I was just putting so much pressure on myself, like all year to like make this team. And I played like terrible. Like my performance was awful. And I eventually I made the team and then played fine. I had to like let go of some of that stuff. But, you know, it's just so stupid, right? It's like, who cares? Like why is this like what? And we have the joke, right? Care. But like, you know, like what? Why am I getting like all worked up about this? And it's like, well, I want to impress people, or I want to like, you know, I want people to think I'm good, or I want. You know, I want to fit in, or like whatever the nonsense is, that's like a distraction from just like remembering like the point of playing the game is to have fun and do the best you can and enjoy the process, and, you know, just focus on yourself. I think, you know, you've been someone that's been really instrumental in helping to like shape my mindset, over time. And it's not easy like to practice that. Like it's hard because, there's a million distractions, you know, all the time. And sometimes the results aren't there that you want to have. And it's not even really about results either, right? Like, it's just about like the process, about like what you're doing. But so you end up, you know, you're in AAA, like your second year, I think.
AAA my first year.
Your first year. Yeah. So you kind of fly through the system, you're having a lot of success, and you have this shoulder injury, and you're trying to be a hero and bearing the weight of everybody's expectations and living in a lot of fear around failure. So you end up having a significant kind of shoulder injury. Do you want to talk us through that?
Yeah. First, I just want to talk about golf. Honestly, it's like one of the beautiful things about baseball is the team sport aspect. And when you are in those tough times, you can rely on your teammates. And I can only imagine how difficult it is for individuals to be playing in high leverage golf. And high leverage is relative, right? If it's your club championship or the PGA Tour, like all of that is on you. And like the limited golf that I've done and the limited competitive golf I've done opens your mind to how difficult the mental side is. There certainly are similarities, but it does seem like the kind of the microscope of everything that is going on, whether or not, you know, success or failure, is all on you. And sometimes that's the way it is in baseball, but you can go out there and give up five runs, and then your teammates back you up and score six runs and you win the game, right? So the difficulties of golf, and I can only imagine like that mental struggle that some guys have to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, I coming from being a team sport guy, you know, and being, you know, really like my DNA is very much like locker room guy, you know, like to being an individual sport, like. I remember the first competitive golf I played, like it was like a qualifier for something. And I just went out and like the first 10 holes, like I was just had this like carefree attitude, like, you know, almost just thinking like, these guys are a bunch of nerds. Like, I don't know, like I played real sports, you know, and, like, I'm just like lighting it up and tearing it up and like making birdies and making pars. And I'm just like, this is like so easy. Like, what's the big deal here? You know? And then I get to like this one hole and I hit a ball out of bounds and I'm like, oh shit, you know? And then I just like, I'm like, oh my God. Like, and then I hit another one out of bounds. And anyway, I end up making like a 12 on the hole. And I'm like, I shoot myself like right out of it, you know? And it's just like, it happened so fast. And like, and I remember the one thought I had was like, holy shit. Like there's no one coming. Like I don't have a teammate. Like no one can come and pick me up right now. Like I am on an island. And, you know, like I remember looking out across this lake and being like, dude, if I could jump in there and just like swim across it and get to the other side and leave, like I would do that. But yeah, it's so different, you know, like, and I think there's similarities, right? I mean, I think like when you're, you know, in a system of a team, you know, if you give up 5 runs and your teammates bail you out, it's not going to help you get to the big leagues. Right. Like, right. So it is individual in that sense. But I definitely think these principles that we're going to talk about, are kind of blown up in an individual sport context when it's just you and you're really put to the test. Like, are you going to focus on what matters or are you going to worry about bullshit? You know, right. You don't have other people to bail you out of the mindset.
Yeah, and when you say like you're on an island, like the pitcher's mound feels like an island sometimes. You certainly have the opportunity to be bailed out, but yeah, that's some of the loneliest, scariest times that you'll ever have is on a mound, right? Like that's those feelings are very, very similar as well.
Yeah, for sure. So, hurting your shoulder as you're like on the precipice of making the major leagues. I think up until kind of this point in your career, I don't want to say you haven't faced adversity, but like, you know, you went from, you know, being a All-Met player of the year to John Olerud award winner to fly through the Mariners system to suddenly, you know, you're in Alabama in front of James Andrews. Talk to us about like what that conversation was like.
That was tough, man. But again, like he was tough for the wrong reasons. Like devastating to hear that I had this pretty catastrophic arm injury. And when he told me like this, there's a really good chance that you'll never play again. My mind was not, you know, on myself for not being able to do what I love. It was like, well, damn, I'm the bust now. I'm the guy that disappointed everybody. I'm the guy that got hurt. Like, those were the first thoughts that went through my mind. I think it was, it's certainly an immature time in my life. And like, I wanted to do well, obviously, but I wanted to do well for the other people. You know, certainly that aspect is, I don't know how to quite say that in the sense that like, you're not necessarily always playing just for yourself in a very egotistical, arrogant way, but kind of in professional baseball, you are until you get to the major leagues. So that's a real aspect. But yeah, I just remember that strange feeling of like, I wasn't upset because I wasn't going to be able to, I potentially couldn't play anymore. It was like, I'm disappointed because I'm disappointing other people. And it took me a long time to kind of shift through that. And even as after that surgery, I was, I had the mentality that I was going to get back to this faster than anybody could. And the fact that he told me that I couldn't play, or I probably couldn't play, was like a driving factor to like, I'm going to be the guy that came back from the shoulder injury and proved to everybody that they were right about this guy getting drafted where he was. And that was the driving motivating factor throughout the first rehab. It's just doing the right things for the wrong reasons was a very common element in my playing days. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And So, Andrew's essentially, look, I wasn't there, but from my understanding is he said you had the worst shoulder he'd seen since Drew Brees, basically.
Yeah.
So he told Danny, you know, like this is you have a torn rotator cuff, a torn capsule, and a torn labrum, the trifecta of shoulder injuries. They operated, and so you know it's funny because you are a man on a mission to get back, and it isn't that insane, right? That like your first thought isn't, oh my God, I'm going to lose the thing I love. And the thing that I've worked my whole life to do. But your first thought is like, I'm going to disappoint other people, right? Like, it's just you put all that work in and you got yourself to that position and you're not disappointed for yourself. You know, you're disappointed for everybody else. And that's quite insane. But obviously very understandable. But it is objectively like, it's insane to look at and think like, you were more bummed for everybody else than you were for yourself, you know? Like,
right.
So, and I remember after that surgery, you know, the following spring, this time of year, being in Arizona and spending time with you there. And I remember throwing the football with you and you were like chucking the football. And I remember thinking like, dude, like I was scared, but you had this like burning driving, like, I'm going to get back, I'm going to do it. So you end up overcoming that injury. I mean, in a way, right? And so talk to us about kind of what happens next.
Yeah. So I had that first surgery and then rehab went well. Once I got back throwing into games, I was starting to feel it again. And those negative thoughts of trying to live up to expectations and pleasing other people started to get back into my mind. It was like, I'm going through this all again. And like, that was insanely frustrating when I reached that point of like feeling like I was who I was before, but still couldn't do it. And unfortunately, I reached another point where I retore everything again. So I had to have that second surgery. I had to have the same surgery a second time, which was horrible because that first surgery, when Dr. Andrews told me that I had a terrible shoulder. It looked like I was in a car accident, and getting looking at it again or doing that all over again, just infinitely lessened my chances of being able to actually get back there. Right. So
yeah,
I ended up having to have a second surgery. And honestly, that was the time where I just mentally flipped the script. And
yeah,
a lot of benefits came from that, honestly, because I had nothing to lose. I had this mentality where I've had these two surgeries. Nobody has ever done this before to any extent. And I still wanted to do it. I still had this burning desire in my mind that I wanted to make it to the major leagues. And I just let go of all the other shit, right? I let go of all the expectations. No one gave a shit about me anymore, which was a good thing. Like the two catastrophic surgeries, there's no way he can come back. And that really helped, honestly. I had a clean slate. I got to go back to University of Virginia and finish my degree. And I grew up, I was older at the time, so I just grew up more, and conversations with you were tremendously helpful. I remember we were eating dinner in Minnesota one time when I was up there visiting, and I was telling you about all these voices and stuff that like had started to come in my head at around that point. And I remember you flat out told me, like, dude, you're going to have to fucking deal with these insecurities somehow. You have to get past this in some way. And I remember that just like simple statement of just, you have to get over this. It's so easy to say. And it was like in the moment, you're just so confounded by all the other shit going on when in reality, the answer is simple, is to just, you have to get over this, whether you're throwing 84 miles an hour with a twice repaired surgery and you don't feel like you can get people out. You need to figure out a way to convince yourself that you're a fucking savage. And
yeah, I remember that conversation. Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, to play it back a little bit, like I do want to zoom in on this. Cause like, so you have a catastrophic shoulder surgery. You're operated by the best orthopedic surgeon in the world. He tells you, this isn't going to happen, buddy. Right. You fucking overcome everything. You come all the way back, you know, you're in spring training, healthy-ish, you know, you're like, the velocity's there, everything's back. And for the most part, boom, the whole thing goes again. And I think, you know, like what happened for you is like you hit rock bottom in a sense, right? Like, and you know, I'm a recovering alcoholic. You've been a huge part of my story there in terms of like helping me with that for the last 15 years. And there is something to that. There is something to like when you bottom out, it's almost like forces you to just like let go of everything because you realize like I am sicker holding on to all this shit, you know, like this is not helping me and I don't have a choice anymore. I'm either going to let go of this or it's going to define me. And I can't go any lower than this, you know? And you had hit bottom, man, like a dark bottom, you know, like there were times where like, you know, I was worried about you. I remember like you go through the second surgery and, you know, you want to say we had conversations, whatever. I'm sure you talked to like a lot of people, but like you on your own, you got to this different place, you know, emotionally, mentally with your mindset. And I remember that conversation. I remember saying, you know, cause it, for me, it's like, dude, this is like, you're Danny fucking Holdson, you know, it's like, I remember saying to you like, dude, like, I don't care if you're throwing 84 or 100, like you've got to believe, you've got to know that like you're a bad motherfucker and you can get people out and you've got to get over, you know, the fear and the insecurity. And you did that on your own, man. And so you have a second total reconstructive surgery of your shoulder, which is unprecedented, you know, unheard of. You're released by the Mariners. And you're at bottom. Everybody's written Danny Holdson off. What's the next part of the story? It's my favorite part.
Yeah, no, that's all absolutely true. I think when you talk about that rock bottom point, that was the time where it was exactly what you just described. It was like, I have nothing to lose. I have to change my mindset. I have to change my attitude. I have to change the way that I deal with insecurities and anxieties, or this isn't going to happen. Right. Like there's still this burning desire that I was going to make the major leagues. And I just really committed to just doing what I thought was best, regardless of what, like any little expectations or any other noise that came into my mind. Like I grew up a lot in the sense that I understood myself better. I understood my body better. I just had been through all these rehabs and understood that like, you don't need to be a fucking superhero. You don't need to be Superman to get through this. Like doing that didn't work. So why the hell would you try to do it again?
Yeah.
And I got back to go. I went back to UVA and I still wanted to play. So I was doing tryouts and I still had some people that I knew that worked in baseball. And I just put my name out there. I was like, will somebody take a chance on me? Like I'll sign for a bag of potato chips. Like whatever, just give me a chance. So one of the pitching coaches that I had with the Mariners was then with the Cubs, and they signed me, and I couldn't have been more elated to have another opportunity. I felt like I was in a better mental space. I was in a better physical space. And with that like relief of anxiety and living up to these expectations that I, one, didn't exist, and two, I didn't give a shit about.
Yeah.
That was so powerful in just my overall mental clarity and happiness in general, was being able to just go out there and play. I had everything to gain and nothing to lose. So I signed in 2018 and rehabbed with the Cubs for most of that season. And then the following year in 2019, I was in a great mental space. I was so driven by the process and not the results, as opposed to the other way around, like I was before. And in September of 2019, I got the call that I was going to the major leagues, and that I can't put into words what that moment was like. That was the culmination of a lot of ups and downs, mostly downs, but I'm so proud to be able to say that I did it, and I got to pitch in the major leagues for a month. That was an unbelievable experience. The goal had been reached, and I was beyond elated for that. And I wanted more. I wanted to continue that. I wanted to, this mental clarity that I had was breeding success, and I felt better about myself. I pitched better. I just like played better. I felt better. Everything was so much better when I just let go of all these bullshit expectations and living and playing for other people and trying to make other people happy. And I just went out and played. I just like, I honestly cared less. Yeah, that's a running joke that in some of our buddies have. It's like, caring is like a really powerful thing. It's like caring about the right things and then really not caring about the things that don't matter. And I think in reality, there's way fewer things. There's way more things that don't matter that you shouldn't care about than you really do should, that you really should care about. And yeah. I started to care about the right things, and that made me so much happier and so feel so much better. And unfortunately, the two surgeries didn't, I don't think anybody's meant to throw a baseball for many, many years after a couple of shoulder surgeries like that. But, I got to play in the major leagues for a month and then unfortunately blew it out the next season, but I'm beyond elated with how everything went at the end.
Yeah. And to back up a little bit, I mean, I think, you know, you have the second total reconstructive surgery and with this renewed mental clarity, and the shedding of expectations that happens, you know, we talked a lot about this at the time, right? Like kind of the space that creates for you, the law of vacuum of space, you know, they'll remember talking about this with you a lot. Like when you let go of something in your mind, something else has to come in and populate it. Usually that's more positive. And with you, it became, your rehab and doing some unique things as part of your rehab that were unorthodox and different. And, you know, not only did you come back from a second total reconstructive surgery of your shoulder, like a second surgery where they said, you're never going to throw a ball again. But, you know, you come back throwing 100 miles an hour, which you never threw before. And so I think if there's any testament to the power of the human mind, you know, that let that be a testament. I mean, I remember you getting the call and you know, I might have been the third or fourth person you texted, and I immediately, you know, got in the car and drove to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to go to your major league debut, and hoping it would be your debut. And sure enough, you know, you do get the call out of the bullpen and you come into the game. And I remember just like, you know, tearing up and crying as a grown man, but just the amount of pride I felt, and happiness I felt for you in that moment, you know, knowing where you had been and where you had gotten yourself, against all of the odds. And what do you do? You freaking go in the game and you strike out the side, including Christian Yelich. Just like throw an absolute, like absolute 96 mile an hour Chad. You got a favorable call or two. But snapping filthy sliders, like, you know, you threw however many innings that, year, you didn't give up a run. You didn't give up a hit. I don't think you gave up a base runner. All-time major league leader in ERA is what I like to say.
I didn't reach the qualifying innings limit. I threw three innings, which was awesome. But
in like six or seven appearances, right? So unfortunately, you know, like you said, the shoulder's not meant to do that, and you had a really interesting, contract with the Chicago Cubs essentially the Cubs knew that like this guy's shoulder's not good, right? And we want some assurances here. And so they, you know, you have like, you had an employment sort of agreement in your contract. My understanding, I'm not your agent, but basically where you could have an opportunity to go to work for the Cubs.
One of my close contacts with the Cubs, we kind of had this verbal agreement where he approached and said like, hey man, we love to have you as a player, but let's just like call a spade, and like your shoulder's really messed up and this may not work out. If we can agree that if your shoulder doesn't last, that you'll come work for us in some capacity. And I was sitting in the chair like, fuck yeah, like this is perfect. The best of both worlds.
Yeah.
I get an opportunity to play, and if it doesn't work out, then I'll get an opportunity and to work for the Cubs in some capacity. So that was so when my shoulder blew out the following year, it was a really easy transition to kind of live up to that and start working in the Cubs organization with the pitching department. And the past couple of years have been great. I've been able to kind of talk to guys that are going through similar things, like talking to some guys that are struggling with arm injuries and we're going through some ups and downs at the major league level. Giving my perspective, and certainly not having like any or all of the answers, but just sharing my experience of how I was able to get through some of those tough times has been very fulfilling and gratifying, and I hope helpful to those players that I've talked to.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it is, man. I mean, when you have that, I'm being from the recovery world, like there's no substitute for lived experience, right? And when you've lived that experience, your testimony becomes more powerful because, what I like to say is like, the things you say aren't debatable. They're your experience. They're facts. So I want to spend a little bit of time here just talking about like some of the things that we've talked about over the years as friends. And the care thing is certainly one component of it, right? Like I'll call Danny and say, hey, Danny, I shot 71 today, and he'll say, care? Yeah. Like that's not important. It doesn't matter. I don't give a shit what you shot, right? So it becomes a joke, but to some extent, like it is a very serious thing, and
yeah,
like just caring less is an incredibly powerful, powerful concept. And let Danny's story and experience be evident. Like the minute he stopped caring what anybody else thought, he found tremendous happiness and joy, and his performance got better.
We certainly joke about the care thing, right? But as I was trying to say earlier, was like, you just need to care about the right things. And there's probably really few things that you actually should care about.
And so what should you care about? If you're a golfer, you've played the game, what should you care about?
I think you should care about the process. That's if you are totally devoted to your swing, your approach, the things that are in your control, then the outcomes happen, right? There's shit that's out of your control. There's shit that just, you get a bad lie, you get a bad kick off the fairway or whatever. Like that's out of your control. But you shouldn't care about those, only in the sense that they should then, if there's a pattern of results that you don't want, then that should change your process, right? That when you stop caring totally about the results, it frees you up. It just like you get out of this crunched space in your mind where everything starts to matter, and you start to freeze on literally every action that you take. If you start to, I'm not saying like to not be detail oriented. You should be 1000% detail oriented in your process. But if you're just truly driven by the results, then you start to think of, oh man, I did that because this happened. I did that because I got to got to this point. I did that. This good thing happened. I got to do it again. Like even just trying to say that kind of stresses me out and like gives you anxiety.
Yeah.
You have this very calm sense of what you're trying to achieve, and the rest is out of your hands, and you don't give a shit about, that. I think that was very powerful for me as a baseball player. And like the limited golf that I played honestly helps too. It's like, if you try to overthink and get over the ball and paralysis by analysis, all that stuff, like that's very real. And like that cue of not caring is so powerful because it frees your body. It frees your mind. I still do that to this day. If I have a, presentation to give or whatever, then and you still feel those like anxious feelings.
It's the first thing we say to each other, care.
Yeah.
It is. Care about, and I think you said it right. It's like, and that's the thing I've learned from you is like, you need to care, but like, you need to care about the right things, the process, and not the outcomes. And then, so I also want to talk a little bit about some of the visualization stuff that we've talked about. Yeah. Like, I think you're a huge believer in visualization. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was something that I didn't really take advantage of until kind of that clean slate phase when I was with the Cubs, where I would start to visualize what my let me backtrack. You have an outcome in your mind. What was super powerful for me, like in baseball, it was a 97 mile an hour fastball dotted up, like down and away to a right-handed hitter. Like that was the end goal, right? But what was so powerful for me was then to start to visualize not only that, but the feelings I had in order to achieve that. So
yeah,
the very literal sense of visualization is like rewatching that same pitch that you've accomplished over and over and over again. And your body starts to fuel with like what that felt like. And I really started to believe in like feelings instead of like mechanical points. Right. And what it like, if I threw a pitch 95 miles an hour, exactly where I wanted it to be, I could then remember what it felt like in order to do that. And then I would just like hammer myself with those feelings of mm-hmm. what did it feel like? First of all, I didn't really give a fuck, so I just was free and easy, right? And then it's like, oh yeah, like, looking back on that, it felt like I was way out front and I felt the snap off my fingers. And then you start mm-hmm. to replay that and ingrain that in your mind, and it really felt like I did this with my back leg. And then you start to realize that you need to get to those points, but you get there through the feelings and not the actual, like, I have to do this with my fingers. I have to do this with my leg. And the times that the golf that I play is the same thing. It's like, if I hit a good drive, mm-hmm. I remember what it feels like. I don't remember the mechanical nuts and bolts of what got there, what it took to get there, but I remember what it felt like to get to that.
Yeah, and so I think what you're talking about is like internal versus external like cues, right? And like, you know, external being like focused on like a body part, or is my wrist doing this, or my, you know, arms doing this thing, you know, and like the thinking versus, I remember like you told me like when you were at your best pitching, you felt like you were pulling into the ground.
Yeah.
You know, like that's an insane thing to say. Like it makes no sense. Obviously that never happened. You didn't disappear into the earth, but that's the feeling you had, right? Was it like when you were in your motion, like you were pulling down into the ground.
Yeah. And like that, finding what works for you takes practice and takes like very directed focus. Right. And then, you know, you even talk about like the positions that you need to get to. There are like very tangible things that are beneficial to a golf swing or a pitching delivery, right? And you talk with people that understand that, like yourself is one of them, the knowing the golf swing in and out. And then when you get into those positions, or you're trying to tell someone how to get in those positions, like you've even told me when I golf, it's like, all right, what does that feel like? And then, right? And it's not necessarily like you have to get to this point. It's, what does it feel like to get to that point? Okay, now replicate that feeling. That mindset of the feelings versus the facts, if that sounds right.
For sure. Feel isn't always real, right? So like you might feel something, but something different is happening. But like it's the feeling that's creating that thing that's different that's happening. It's not like you're manufacturing that thing happening. Like you're feeling something specific that's creating that. And so, and sometimes those things can be very different. You know, like I might feel like my shoulder's closed. Does that actually happen? No, but like it keeps my hip from flying open or whatever the example is. And then on the visualization front, I remember like, you know, you talked about like with me, like, you know, you want to kind of like envision yourself shooting 59, right? And like, and one of the things that I really took away from that conversation was like, it's like when you talk about envisioning the process, like instead of like the old school visualization that I always used was like, okay, yeah, see yourself like, and see the ball, you know, flying through the air. But it was like, no, like you want to envision yourself like going through your pre-shot routine, you know, like, and then getting over the ball, and you want to envision the feeling of knowing that you're going to hit it like right where you want to hit it, you know?
Absolutely.
Right. And that's like, it's like training. It's like envisioning the confidence that you're going to have versus like envisioning the process versus envisioning the outcome, you know?
Yeah. And they could, and they certainly can go hand in hand, right? Like there's sometimes where like you envision yourself hitting this 150 yard approach shot 3 feet from the green. And then all you have to do is let it happen. Like, that's another,
that's the other thing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's another like concept that I found very, very powerful was letting things happen as opposed to trying to force them to happen. And that is relatable across all sports, right? Like if I, you know, as using my baseball experience, if I envisioned that 95 mile an hour pitch, you're gonna have to edit this part. I'm losing my train of thought.
No, you're fine. Yeah. No, I mean, because you've said that to me where it's like, hey, you know, you want to, and that's such a, it's such an amazing like parallel to golf, you know, like, and this was such an eye opener for me. I remember like standing over shots and wanting to force the ball to the hole, you know, wanting to like make it happen. Like I'm going to take this little fucking white ball and I'm going to white knuckle it into the hole. You know, I'm going to force it, you know, and you end up like pressing and pressing and pressing instead of like what you've helped me understand is like, no, like let it happen. Right. Yeah. Like allow your athleticism to take over, allow your body to do what it's supposed to do. You know, and I think that became really relevant for you in your pursuit of velocity, right? Where you started letting it happen, like letting it happen versus trying to force, you know, like muscle the ball to 100 miles an hour, but actually like letting it happen. And I think like overnight, like you're like, oh my God, I'm throwing like 98.
Yeah. And like I talk to players about this all the time is, and even in golf, right? Like across any sport, is the hardest pitch you've ever thrown or the nastiest pitch you've ever thrown or the furthest drive or the best approach shot or the best putt, I can almost guarantee that you didn't know how it happened, right? It just happened. Like that 340 yard drive, it was, I guarantee most people would say like, yeah, I wasn't really trying. It just kind of happened. And the hardest pitch that guys have ever thrown, the nastiest pitches they've ever thrown, same thing. I guarantee 99% of them would say like, yeah, that kind of came out of nowhere. I wasn't forcing it. I just kind of let it happen. I was fluid. Like that tense mind creates tense muscles, which then slows you down. That was something I needed to constantly remind myself when I was playing, was to let things happen as opposed to forcing them to happen for all those reasons that we talked about. But then like, that's also connected to like the care thing, right? Like if you just let it happen, then the care of like trying to creating it and forcing it to happen is just completely melts away. And you've done it enough times, and with the visualizations, you've ingrained it in yourself to so many times that the only thing you can do right now, and the thing that's most beneficial to you, is to get the fuck out of your own way and just let it happen.
Yeah. I love that. And the listeners are getting a glimpse into just like the hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of conversations over the years that like Danny and I have had late into the night, exactly like this, just talking about performance, sports, life. You know, I mean, there's lots of parallels to the business world and other areas of life, you know, like this. And so, you know, we could go on forever because we do and we will. And maybe if our listeners really like it, we'll start recording our conversations. But one last thing to cover before we drop is, you're working for the Chicago Cubs. A lot of interesting like parallels kind of between pitching, baseball, and golf now that we've talked about, you know, that are probably worthy of an episode, right? But you know, I think one of the big advents or realizations in golf around analytics has been that, like, look, golfers don't control the ball nearly the amount that they think they do, particularly the amateur and even the professional. I mean, the dispersion, you know, once we sort of got shot tracker data and we saw, like, holy shit, an average PGA Tour pro, it's a 7-iron, 35 yards left to right in dispersion. You know, the idea that me or anybody as even a good amateur player is going to go out and have control over their ball is, like, hilarious and insane. Like, right. You don't, right? So these things, these principles that we're talking about become really relevant because it's like, dude, like, the wind can do something weird. You can have a weird lie. Like, fucking altitude could affect it. You could get a gust. Like, the idea that you are going to, like, hit the ball where you're looking 100% of the time or even 50% of the time is very unlikely.
Yeah.
We're kind of finding that in baseball too. I mean, yeah. Even the guys that have the best command, like, do they really command it? Like, exactly. Maybe educate us on that.
Yeah. No, that's a great parallel. I think from the pitching standpoint, trying to relate it to golf is guys do not command the ball. By that, I mean, they hit their intended locations nearly as well as we would think they do. The average miss in Major League Baseball, I think now is probably around 8 inches, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it can be the difference between a strikeout and a home run.
That's right? Like half the size of the plate. I mean,
yeah,
that's like, I'm throwing it inner half and I miss it middle.
Yeah, like, exactly. So you talk about like feel and real. Where,
yeah,
you know, from a baseball standpoint, if I try to dot a pitch down and away and I miss, like, you know, X percent of the time, which is way less than we think it is, you hit that spot. There's a much larger percent of the time where you either miss that pitch over the plate that could potentially get hit for damage. You miss it arm side for a ball. You pull it down for a ball like that. The mentality of, like, you don't have control as much as you think you do is limiting to some guys that maybe are kind of connected to the sense that they can put the ball wherever they want. But it's also freeing in a lot of ways because it's like, dude, this is out of my control. Like, I can just, like, set up over the plate and, like, kind of throw my best pitch and throw as hard as I can. And where it goes is somewhat out of my control. It's certainly, some guys are better at it than others, but I think the idea of, you know, in golf, the scent, if you're 150 yards away, that they're putting it within 2 feet of the hole every time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a guy that doesn't know golf that well, like, that is what I would think a PGA Tour player does with a lot of consistency. And then in baseball, one of the eye-opening things was how bad some guys' misses are pretty consistently. And good command in professional baseball is really, really valuable. But I think less guys have it than one would expect, right?
Yeah, I remember my good buddy Ben Siegel, who's you know, trying to make it in golf. He caddied for me in the club championship, and he said, like, the first thing he said was, "Andy, today we're gonna appreciate the average shot," you know?
Yeah,
and it was like, yeah, it's like, dude, I pulled it onto the green 40 feet away. Like, that's an average shot, and a lot of guys would be like, fuck, you know, yeah, like, damn, like, but it's like, no, like, but that's actually a good shot. Like, and we're just so much, like, harder on ourselves than we need to be, you know. Like, I leave a ball out over the plate or whatever, and I'm like, you know, it's almost like arrogant to think, like, oh, well, I could have hit it to 3 feet. Like, yeah. No, I couldn't have, or maybe I could have sometimes, but then again, you know, there's the shotgun theory of, like, well, if I'm missing equally left and right, and I move my shotgun over the hole and it's on the right side of the green, half my misses are now going to be off the green and half my misses are going to be next to the hole, versus if my aiming point is in the middle of the green, now my misses to the right aren't off the green, they're next to the hole, and my good shots, my average shots, are in the middle of the green, right? So I think there's a lot of, like, parallels in baseball that we've talked about with, like, kind of where pitching's going, and probably much to the chagrin of the old timers who, you know, had command in their day. Right. But at the velocity that guys are throwing now, like,
oh yeah,
it's really hard to freaking command the ball.
Just drawing a comparison to baseball and golf. I listened to your guys' podcast about the, I think it was Decades Golf.
Yeah. Scott Fawcett.
Yeah. That was so fascinating because everything he talked about is what is trying to be implemented in Major League Baseball right now. Like playing the percentages, playing the misses, understanding your miss patterns, giving yourself margin for error. Like that, all of that is like very, very real in professional baseball. And like sending that message to Major League players and professional baseball, and professional players as a whole can sometimes be difficult. It's like, hey man, like we almost want you to aim right down the middle where we think where if you hit that spot, it, you know, could get hit. But like, we actually don't think you're going to hit that spot all that often. And if you're going to miss, you'll miss on the corner for a good pitch on the black, or you'll miss up and get under his barrel. That message can be difficult to send because you're basically betting against them that you're not going to hit their spot. And, you know, some guys and myself included, I looked at my own statistics and I was like, oh my God, why was I trying to be so perfect? Like, why did if I just like aimed down the middle and just like let my misses play, like, I think I would have been better. And I also wouldn't put this extra pressure on myself to try to like be pinpoint all the time. Sorry to cut you off, but we actually use the golf parallel all the time when we do this, when we do these presentations. It's like the best thing you can possibly do in a golf shot from 100 yards away is put it in the hole, right?
Yeah.
The best thing you can do is dot that pitch down and away or up and in. But like, let's look at the actual reality of the odds of you doing that. And unfortunately, it's lower than you would hope. But it's also the reality of the situation where you're actually at you're putting yourself in the best opportunity to aim a little bit more over the plate or a lot bit over the plate. And in golf, like, you're actually doing yourself a service by aiming for the bunker or aiming for the water.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Yeah, no. And I mean, it goes back to like, you know, at a certain level, you know, everybody's good is like pretty similar. I mean, obviously, like, there's guys in baseball that have like really plus pitches or outlier pitches or whatever. But like, you know, for the most part, like the like a guy's best, you know, stuff or whatever on their best day, right, is like pretty comparable, like at the highest level. Like, you know, like even like my best drive I've ever hit is like, you know, it's like Rory McIlroy's drive, you know, or whatever, right? Like, but it's not the best that defines you as a player. It's your worst. It's your misses. Yeah. You know, like that's the difference between guys that are like elite and guys that are like okay. You know, it's like at some level, everybody can do, like, I can get on a driving range and flush a 5-iron like DJ. You know, like like the one in a million or whatever. But it's not that one shot that is going to make the difference. It's all the misses and how good can we get at missing. And again, you know, this all ties together nicely because it's all part of the mindset of like, dude, like, you know, who cares about the outcome? Like, it's not really even in your control. Exactly. And if you miss, like, who cares? Like, you're supposed to miss, you know? But what you don't want to start doing is now getting tight and now aiming. Right. And now your misses are even worse, you know? And it's like, no, just allow your misses to be your misses.
Yeah, no, I think that's perfect. That's like I think as athletes across any sport, you think that you're in control of literally everything. And when you think that and believe that, then it forces it, I think, subconsciously creates the stress that you have to be the best at everything, and you have to mm-hmm. force things, and you have to force every single aspect. When I think in the reality is, it's like there is a lot of stuff you can control, and that's what you should focus on, and that's what you should like work your ass off to be consistent with. But there's also a lot that's way out of your control, and you can't beat yourself up, and you can't live like the day by those outcomes. Like, you have to be so process driven. Not necessarily care about the granularity of the day results, but that mentality of like, I'm going to do what I can control and not give a fuck about the other side. That's consistent. That's You can do that for a really fucking long time. You will not, you won't drive yourself nuts with that type of mentality.
Yeah.
And that, and you know, it goes without being said, but like when we say don't care, it's not, not giving a shit, not working hard, not doing anything, but
right. Of course
it's caring about the things that you're in control of.
Yeah. Well, man, you have such an amazing like story, you know, real life story of how that impacted you and affected you. And, you know, you're a lot harder on yourself than anybody else is. and most people look like the reality is like most people deal with this stuff. Very few people talk about it. And so, you know, I think it's inspiring and really cool that you're willing to like be open about your experiences as a, as an elite, you know, top level athlete, right? Like, you know, tip of the spear, like top of the world athlete that you know, faces the same things that the idiot who's playing in their member guest and shaking over the ball because they're worried about where they're going to hit it has faced, you know, and to normalize that, that performance anxiety and that fear of failure, and to help people, you know, have a toolkit to work out of that and find a more sustainable model of how to approach life and not only performance in sports, but in general, I think is something I've learned from you over the years, and you've shown me through your experience, and it's been incredibly valuable for me in many areas of my life, but especially in my golf game. So I couldn't go much longer without having you on the Member Guest podcast, because you know, whenever I'm down about my game, the first person that I call is Danny. And I'm usually greeted with a, why do you care so much? But dude, I really appreciate you doing this, man. This was awesome. And yeah, also great to like look back and think about our friendship over the years too, and kind of connect the dots.
Yeah, so. This has been great, man. Thank you for everything. Thank you for having me. This is, yeah, hopefully this is just the tip of the iceberg. Maybe we'll get another chance to talk through this, but yeah, man, all those nice things you said about me, I really appreciate. And they go the same way to you, man. You helped me through a lot during my playing career. You helped me a lot with off the field stuff, which we'll save for not the podcast. But thank you. Thank you for everything.
Yeah, of course, buddy. All right. Love you, man. Thanks for coming on. And hope our listeners got something out of this episode.
Beautiful. Thank you.